Good morning and welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show. I'm Amy Otto, joined by Lee Cantor. Good morning, Lee.
Good morning, Miss Amy. How are you doing this? Is it fall? Is it summer? What is it?
It's feeling like fall.
When does fall actually begin? Do you know?
That's a great question. I think it's in 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
Somewhere around the 21st of September.
So we passed Labor Day. Your kids are in the full swing of school.
Yes. Did you have a good Labor Day?
Yeah, great.
We went to Callaway Gardens. I love that place.
What'd you do?
Biked, hiked.
All that outdoor
kayaked.
Stuff?
Yeah. I mean, everything I love to do is right there, and it's so pretty.
Did you see any animals?
We didn't see any wildlife at all. I was surprised. But, you know, we explored the restaurants there this time a little bit more thoroughly, and there's some really good spots to eat.
Cool.
Yeah, it was a great trip. I recommend people checking it out. They've got all kinds of great packages. The hot air balloon festival was going on.
Did you go on a hot air balloon?
I didn't. They were tethered. It seemed kind of wimpy
after
doing the real
silly
thing. Yeah, it did. But people were excited about it.
So they just lifted you up and then brought you back down?
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't really that high. I was watching, and I mean, it was pretty at night. That was kind of
right,
the appeal to it. But I wasn't all that excited about it. But I'm excited about our guest this morning, Lee.
Yes.
We're doing a special feature. Welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show this morning. We have Don Ely. Welcome.
Thank you. I appreciate being here.
So, Don, your company is a little bit different. We get on the Atlanta Business Radio Show frequently, people that do the CFO to hire, the CEO to hire. It's like just about everything, except what you're doing is very different. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yes, the legal industry hopefully is now going to catch up with all the other industries out there that offer this part-time chief executive service for companies who are not quite at the Coca-Cola level of a couple of $1 billion a year. When you're a smaller company and you don't have the resources to fully fill out your chief executive suite with your CFO, your COO, and your in-house counsel, those companies that are at that smaller growing level are still needing the same services. There's not a difference in complexity or in need of having the in-house counsel role with these small and emerging and growing companies, but they don't have the resources to hire them. So as I have spent 20 years being an in-house counsel myself, and mostly in the healthcare and technology areas, I saw how a $3 billion a year company could use an in-house counsel just walking down the hallway, and somebody says, hey, you know, did you see that pricing up on the internet? And, you know, knowing that we were a dual channel company, and I, you know, immediately saw some issues with that. And I thought, you know, these are companies that can afford this kind of level of employee. What are companies that are small or operating in the same space doing? Because they don't know what they don't know, the business managers. And they shouldn't be expected to know how all the various different legal issues intertwine within their business, whether it's antitrust or distribution or other things. And so I created what has been done in other industries, which is the part-time chief legal officer, so that it can help companies that are small and growing that can't afford a full-time, you know, 200-plus thousand a year employee plus benefits and bonus, to have that same benefit of that industry and business knowledge combined with that legal knowledge.
Now, when you define part-time, when you place someone, are they there a day a week, or does it just depend on the industry or the location?
Well, it depends on their needs and initially their desires. But when I say part-time, I usually mean like a 1 or 1.5 or 2 or 2.5, 3, 3.5 day a week,
mm-hmm.
sort of like a part-time employee. So they're there physically on site. They're on the management team. They're not remote. So this is not a virtual thing. This is not a law firm lawyer, you know, kind of filling in as the de facto GC, which a lot of law firms like to say they do. This is truly on-site, part-time, as if they were an employee, but nobody can tell they're not an employee. You just don't have the infrastructure costs. So that part-timeness depends on the level of operating of that company. And a lot of times we get in there, and they frequently don't quite understand what the value of that in-house counsel is going to be until they get there.
Mm-hmm.
So a one-day week turns into a two-day week, and a two-day week turns into a three-day week really fast.
They find the need very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah.
Now, can you talk about why it's important to be on-site as opposed to virtual? Like, you made a point to differentiate that way.
Yeah, it's critical if you're going to truly be an in-house counsel. The value of the in-house counsel is that they're industry experts as much as they are legal experts. And by industry, I mean they know the business. And so, you know, myself, for example, I'm healthcare and technology. We have a great telecom lawyer within Palladium. And we know how that industry operates, but it's important to understand how that business operates on a day-to-day basis. So if you see something that comes up that typically will flow throughout that industry, an antitrust issue or, you know, a regulatory issue, whatever it is, if you don't understand the business's day-to-day operations, you can't suggest the least restrictive business way to handle and minimize that risk. What ends up happening most of the time with law firm lawyers is, you know, just by virtue of them being remote, they can't make suggestions on how to do it better. All that they can do is tell you yes or no. This you can't do, that you can't do. And so with an in-house counsel, we like to say we see the possibilities, not just the liabilities, so that we can actually be part of the solution.
That's a great way of looking at it, too. Right. You see the possibilities, and I can see that that would definitely be a benefit. Are there times when a company would still need to utilize a law firm?
Absolutely. It's the way I analogize the CLO and the law firm is the same way that people are accustomed to using a CFO and a CPA firm. Most people understand the concept that they need both because they perform different roles. That's the same thing with a chief legal officer and a law firm lawyer. The chief legal officer knows the industry, knows the detail of the business, and knows how the legal issues are going to impact the business and can translate. That's what I like to call our CLOs is we're translators in between business and legal issues. But the law firm lawyer, like for example, when I had worked for a very large international company, we had an issue that was an antitrust issue because we had two channels of operating, both a direct sales force and we used other third parties like distributors and OEMs. And they ended up competing in the same marketplace for the same customers, for the same products, for the same, you know, at the same time. And, you know, so we had some issues with price, knowing who knew what pricing and how that information flowed. And I called in an expert in antitrust to help me with the depths of that knowledge of that antitrust. So I'll be able to, and your chief legal officer will be able to understand how to get by on the day-to-day operations. But when you need deep dive knowledge, you know, our CLOs are sort of a mile wide and an inch deep, except for in a couple of areas, like my specialty is healthcare and technology. I'm a mile deep in technology and healthcare, but not in antitrust, not in employee relations, not in real estate and leasing and things like that. So that's when I call in the experts in those areas who are a mile deep in those areas to fill in and help me make sure I'm making the right decisions in those areas.
It sounds like you definitely have a passion for educating. How do you stay up to date on everything? Because the industry and the laws do change, especially in healthcare and technology. How do you keep up to date?
Well, it's I keep up to date in a couple of different areas. One is certainly the legal issues. You know, I have to keep up with the healthcare and various licensing and patenting and technology type issues. And, you know, you belong to various different organizations that send you things and you go to continuing education. And a lot of it is just seeing how industry is evolving. A lot of times industry starts changing how they're doing contractual relationships and strategic relationships. And so you start having to adjust what you know about the laws to how to apply them in the context of the business relationship. And in most cases, your chief legal officer is going to be most equipped to do that. But my other passion for education is really around sort of the soft skills like negotiation for women. And teaching those early in their careers how to be a good in-house counsel, teaching law firm lawyers who are just starting out how to work with an in-house counsel, because it's a completely different way of practicing law, just like being a CFO is very different from being a CPA CPA firm.
Can you talk a little bit about, from the customer standpoint, your client, are they, like, where are they at from a legal standpoint? Do they just never have had a chief legal officer? Or like, what stage are they at? Or they had one, they left, and then they think this is a transition? You know, how do you fit in the...
Well, it depends on whether they want an interim general counsel or chief legal officer or whether they want a part-time one. Those who want an interim, sometimes they have had one before, or they maybe have just gotten so big so fast through an acquisition or something like that where now all of a sudden they're double or triple or exponentially larger and they know that they need one tomorrow. And so we'll go in as the interim general counsel and help them do a permanent search for that. But the vast majority of our part-time and Palladium CLO business is those companies who are $75 million a year in revenue and below. They're just not at the size where they're it makes sense to invest the resources in a full-time lawyer employee. You know, every day these companies are having to make resource decisions about who to hire, what type of position to hire, and where they're going to put their limited resources as they're trying to grow. So, you know, putting that in a part-time chief legal officer actually can be an extremely effective use of that investment and that resource to help further their objectives.
And how do you know if the CLO is the right fit? I mean, do you put somebody in, and if it doesn't work, you have the flexibility to switch that person out? How do you work that?
Yeah, I think the most important thing to know about when's the right or who is the right CLO for a company is industry knowledge. Mm-hmm. You know, I, as a healthcare and technology person, would never go work for a telecom company. That's just silly. The value of your CLO is that industry knowledge. And so you have to have that industry background. And if you haven't already worked inside a corporation as a divisional or general counsel, then you really don't have quite the skills yet to be on your own in a company and helping that company as on the management team deal with the day-to-day issues. So the first two criteria are industry background and actual time served, if you will, in a corporation as a divisional or general counsel. And then after that, it's really important that the right personality fit is there, because these are not just document deliverers, as a lot of people think of lawyers as. They don't just deliver contracts and revise contracts and, you know, do those kinds of things. It's really important to have somebody who has the perspective of risk management. I understand that there is a potential that we could get in trouble for this. If somebody interpreted this law in this way, or somebody decided they got really irritated and wanted to file a lawsuit, there could be a potential interpretation of the contract in this other way. But sometimes those risks are so remote that you just can't possibly manage your business by that. You know, I used the analogy of walking outside. We all get the chance and we all face the risk that we could get hit by a bus. Well, okay, the risk of that is the severity is pretty severe if it were to happen, but the likelihood is pretty darn low. So, you know, most of us don't run our lives by that. That's the same concept we have to run in the CLO business, and that makes law firm lawyers usually very uncomfortable, because they're used to being in a position of risk aversion completely. It's a yes or no answer in most cases for them, or they research it. Whereas we have to deal with day-to-day business issues. And, you know, we don't do anything crazy like we know we've done something really wrong over here and we know it's going to cost too much money to fix it, so what's the risk that we'll get caught? Mm-hmm. It's not that kind of risk assessment. It's the things that, you know, we think we can, you know, support what we're doing. We're trying to do the right thing, and, you know, we think it's not, you know, a big risk.
Now, how does that culturally fit into the companies you work with? Because that's a change kind of how they're used to dealing, isn't it?
Well, and that's one of the great values of the CLO, is because we can translate the legal issues into business impact. What does this mean financially for you? What does this mean in terms of your business relationships with this person or that person? How could this legal term that you think is legalese and doesn't mean anything but, you know, some offhanded courtroom, how is this going to impact you day to day? And when you are able to translate that, people think, oh, wow, well, I hadn't thought of it that way. That's really what that means? And so once you're able to be in the hallways and in the management team meetings and in the marketing meetings and on all these regular day-to-day environments, you start educating the workforce and you start educating the managers, and they start becoming much more aware of what those legal issues mean for them. And they start taking better responsibility for the impact of what they do for the company. And it becomes a much more communal culture where people are able to talk openly with each other, and they take responsibility, and then they seek out the legal advice, not because it's a litigation matter or a tax matter or some of those specialty things when people usually think to pick up the phone to call their lawyer. It's a combination of business and legal issues, and you almost really can't separate the two and know where one begins and the other one ends.
Those are great points. You know, oftentimes I'll ask our guests to tell us a success story, but this morning I'm so thrilled that we have a success story and we have one of your satisfied customers here to talk about how you've helped them. Welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show, Bernie Wolford. Welcome.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell us how it worked. You were looking for in-house counsel. How did you find out about Dawn? And maybe walk us through that relationship and how you've benefited from her services.
Well, the setting was a healthcare technology company. Beyond startup, out of the garage, but what I categorize as an emerging growth company. And just by the definition of being in the healthcare space, issues such as HIPAA compliance, the raising of capital, the bringing in of new investors, you know, adds another dynamic. There are never enough hours in the week. And so, you know, sort of painting a picture of the environment in which I first met Palladium, and Dawn was the CLO on that in that company. So, every corner you turned, every office you walked into, there was an issue.
Mm, wow.
10 o'clock in the morning, the issue perhaps was a dissatisfied investor. At 11 o'clock, a contract to be signed with a joint venture partner. After lunch, another situation. So even at that relatively small size company, the need for counsel was there and always there. And then, to state the obvious, a company that is under-resourced, trying to raise capital to do many things, the very thought of a full-time in-house counsel was beyond the reach of the company. At that stage, and so what a great solution mm-hmm. to find a model such as Palladium, where the access to those resources were not only accessible but affordable as well.
So, what were they doing before? They were just going to a law firm and saying, "Hey, I need this taken care of on a case by case basis."
I think anything that would be described as legal. Was in the form of documents, of contracts, employment contracts, some joint venture partnership contracts and so forth, which actually predated my arrival, but I can only assume that was done in sort of a one-off
right.
outside counsel modus operandi until Palladium was
so
on
then the Palladium comes in and then they're there, physically there.
Yes.
So then you can
yes.
just go down the hall with this rather than...
Oh, it was always fun to interrupt Dawn, knowing that she was working on a deadline for someone else. But suddenly, your division had a need. So the accessibility, and of course, anytime resources are scarce, you are painfully aware of getting on the phone and bringing in a several hundred dollar per hour counsel for something that those dollars could be used
for something
elsewhere,
else, right.
yeah. And not that Palladium was or is free, but there's a sense that that's now a budgeted, consistent monthly line item. It's
right.
kind of a sunk cost, and sure. so it's easier to see utilizing that asset.
Were there certain times of year where there was more of a need for her? I mean, I guess that's a question for Dawn too. In some industries, there may be certain months or certain times of the year that are busier or may need more legal counsel. Is that? Am I making a good assumption? No, it's always there.
No, yeah, not really. It may happen more often depending upon what's going on in the business. Like mm-hmm. if there's a big strategic partnership or deal that's coming down the pike, where that they're trying to negotiate, that happens. And in fact, with Bernie's division, we got to the point where whenever they came to me and told me the context of what they wanted to do with a particular contractual relationship. I would always put aside the contract, the document, and start talking to them. What do you want to accomplish with this business relationship? What are your objectives? What are you trying to, is this exclusive? Is it non-exclusive? Are there minimum purchases? And go through all of these things that I know from an industry background are frequently described in these kinds of relationships. And, I would ask them sometimes questions, and they'd say, oh, well, I don't know about that. Why does that matter? And so I would explain to them why that would impact them. And then it would, they'd say, oh, okay, well, let me go back and talk to them about that. And that happened so many times that, in fact, they just started bringing me to some of the discussions with the prospective partner or alliance or customer so that I could be there because I wasn't a threatening lawyer. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they would actually not even tell them that I was a lawyer, but just simply because I would be able to bring up questions, whether I slewed them a note in the middle of the meeting so that they could ask it or whether I would ask it, just from a business standpoint, I need to know how the business structure is going to work so that I can create the contract that's going to meet their objectives.
That's a great point. And your expertise in a vertical market would absolutely present that. And it's almost like you don't know what you don't know. I mean, they probably didn't even know that those were issues that could come up until you brought them up. That's a great point.
No, and, you know, I don't want to take away at all from what Bernie has some wonderful things to say, I hope. But, you know, two just specific situations with this particular client. When I first came in, it was the very first day that I came in and was meeting with the chairman and the president. And they handed me a list of documents that, you know, they believed that lawyer they needed a lawyer for, and that was one of the reasons, you know, biggest reasons why I was there, is they had a whole list of documents they knew needed to be done. And so I looked at that list of 10 documents, and I put that aside. I said, that's lovely. Let's talk about your business. And so after 45 minutes, you know, what do you do? What do you sell? Who do you sell it to? How do you make it work? You know, what are your objectives? How do you market it, et cetera, et cetera? I found out after 45 minutes that they had a relatively Me Too kind of service, but they were putting this Star Wars software system on top of it. That was their market distinguisher. They wanted to patent it, and that was going to just catapult them in front of everybody else in the marketplace. Well, I also learned in that conversation that it was being developed exclusively by a third-party software developer, and they did not have a contract in place yet, but they had a gentleman's agreement. And so I went back and I took that list of 10 documents, and I said, let's take a look at this again. And I'm going to rearrange some things, because on their list, the first two or three items were just general corporate administrative things, got to have eventually, but certainly not urgent. The last thing on their list, almost as an afterthought of they said, oh, yeah, oh, let's put that on the list too, was to have a consulting agreement and a contract between them and the software developer. And I said, okay, I'm going to take your number 10, and I'm going to put it on top, and I'm going to do it. It's 3 o'clock right now, and I'm going to do this before I leave the office, and I want you to send it to them today. And here's why. You probably don't realize this, but it's not intuitive, but nobody owns anything the third-party contractor does for them unless you have a written contract that says very specific legal terms, work for hire. And if you don't have that, doesn't matter that you're paying them, doesn't matter that it's your idea, doesn't matter that they're your specifications. You don't own it. So what does that mean for you? It means you can't patent it, and they can go sell it to your competitors today. So what would that do to your business?
Wow.
So after I picked them up off the floor, then, you know, we did that. Another example of this particular client is before I came on, as you were talking about with Bernie, they did use an outside law firm for specific contracts. And, you know, this is not law firm bashing because the law firms are very valuable. But this is the kind of stuff that can happen on a regular basis if there is not adequate supervision in the law firm when training law firm lawyers that are young. They were working on a deal between them as a reseller and another manufacturer. They were going to resell the manufacturer's product. Mm-hmm. They had asked a law firm lawyer to draft up this contract. Well, after I arrived, that contract then arrived, which, of course, came then to me. Well, it turns out that what that had happened is it was clear that this work had been pushed down to a low-level associate that did not have much experience and had probably zero experience in the industry. And the reason I say that is because they clearly used a version of this contract when they had represented the manufacturer side of the transaction, because they left many of the manufacturer favorable terms in the contract, including a non-compete for our own reseller client.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was bad. And so I was able to fix that because I had industry experience, but I also understood the business and what they were trying to accomplish. And again, this, you know, the law firm partner who is in charge of this, I know would never have done that, but there was not adequate supervision of what he gave this other person to do. And as an in-house counsel, that's one of the values that we offer for the client is usually the relationship with that outside law firm will fall to the CFO or a COO or somebody like that, and they don't have the expertise to be able to identify when something is not appropriate, but they also don't have time for this. That's not their core responsibility. They need to be left alone from the legal issues and the contract issues so that they can go and do their core responsibilities, whether it's finance or whether it's operations, etc. And, you know, whether there's a litigation thing going on or a threat of litigation or it's just day-to-day contractual relationships. You know, you don't want, you're paying your CFO or your COO good money. You don't want them to have to be distracted with legal issues that they, number one, don't have the expertise for, right, and number two, don't have the time for.
Yeah, or don't understand.
I mean, exactly.
That would definitely make sense. So, Bernie, are you still using the CLO? You still have someone in-house with Don, or is Don the person?
I finished my involvement. Mm-hmm. I was similar to Don's model as a CLO. I was a bit of a VP of operations, general manager under a multi-year contract with the company. But one of the takeaways from my experience there was the value of the in-house counsel. And certainly upon finding myself in the future in a similar situation, that will be a top of mind option to use. I need no convincing whatsoever about the value mm-hmm. of it. One thing that obviously when you're speaking about legal issues and in-house or out-of-house counsel, you're talking about risk, mm-hmm. And you're either trying to manage that risk or you're trying to react to some threat that mm-hmm. that's appeared that has a legal connotation to it. And it's almost moved from luxury to necessity. Mm-hmm. Even the smallest of the small companies in manufacturing widgets, we're in such a litigious
You're right.
society. Someone will claim they had the widget first, or mm-hmm. I've been involved with probably 10 to 12 emerging growth companies, similar to the one that Don and I have been using as an illustration. And in thinking over a cup of coffee this morning, I think 100% of them were either in litigation or threatened with litigation of some sort.
Wow.
And so it's almost predictable. It's going to be there. And so a small company has to decide how will we react to it, or how will we be more preventative, knowing that it's going to be there. And the obviously, we'd all like to be preventative as much as we can. And as Don has mentioned, having the in-house counsel a few doors down the hall, pulling them into general management meetings, giving them a view of the horizon, not just the bow of the ship, is a huge preventative part of managing the risk of that business.
No doubt. Now, Don, you have, I can't believe I'm looking at your resume. 2 decades of experience. You don't look that old, but...
thank you.
It must be the triathlon.
Something like that.
What's been the biggest change you've seen in those 20 years? Because, like Bernie just mentioned, it really has changed the complexion of business, mm-hmm. especially healthcare and technology has really yep. changed from a legal perspective. What are the big changes that are obvious that you've seen in 20 years?
That's an interesting question. I think the biggest changes I've seen are some more positive and some not as positive. Some of the more positive ones are that business leaders are starting to see that there is a connection between legal and business, that it's not just lawyers doing litigation or lawyers, giving you tax advice or lawyers giving you antitrust advice, that there is a role for lawyers in the context of business. They're not all there yet, but there's headway being made. So the fact that we say that, we can see the possibilities, not just the liabilities, and we help people achieve their objectives, not just prevent bad things, we're starting to see that. In the healthcare space particularly, there's, a lot more regulation and there's a lot more enforcement of regulation. I remember way back 10 years ago when I was in a healthcare medical device company, and I said, guys, I'm not so sure why they're not going after the GPOs, because honestly, The group purchasing organizations technically are violating fraud and abuse. I'm not sure how they're getting away with that, but I would be really careful here. I have a feeling the OIG might start going after them. And, you know, the business manager, Don, we've been doing this for 20 years, and it's never going to happen. That's just the way it is. Okay. Well, it wasn't more than a year, 18 months later, and all of a sudden, wow, the GPOs were under, you know, OIG and FTC's thumb. So it was, I thought, okay, well, now that makes a little bit more sense. Mm-hmm. But so you've seen some things that are really changing in terms of enforcement, which is scary for a lot of companies, but it's also... You know, it makes some kind of sense because healthcare is the highest increase in costs year over year, and there's more fraud, frankly, in the healthcare industry than there is even in the finance industry, which is kind of crazy and scary to think about, but that's true. So, you know, those are some of the potential frightening things in the healthcare space. But I really see, just as other industries have done in the finance and HR, where they've created this part-time chief executive where you can be in-house, the lawyers are now not just sitting up in the ivory tower across the cavern where you have to jump over there to get to them. If you've got the right personality lawyer, they can really add a lot to the business. And I'm seeing a little bit more acknowledgement of their role in that business. And I'll tell you a very short story. When a lawyer who understands the industry, understands the regulations and the laws so that they can weave them and weave the business in and out of them in a way that is successful and achieves objectives, that's what you want. For example, I have a client where my background in regulatory and FDA work has been very helpful because I told them that they could get a certain claim on their product that everybody else said they couldn't get. You know, people who had been in the industry for 20 years and they were engineers and said, this is what we've always done, therefore this is what we're always going to do and this is what we only can do. And I said, no, horse poop. You know, there are ways that you can, you should be able to get this, and here's why I know this, and here's why I think this based on my knowledge of the regulations and knowledge of the business. Mm-hmm. Well, it turns out we were able to get a claim that nobody else thought. Luckily, the business leaders had trust and faith in me that I knew what I was talking about, and we went for it, and we were successful. And had I not been there, and this is true with other CLOs, had the CLO who knows the business and the legal issues, have they not been there, a lot of times they would not, the business would not be as successful as quickly.
Now, talking about other lawyers that work with you, can you just share, like, who are these lawyers? Where are they coming from, and what do they like about working in this kind of a way?
We have lawyers coming from various industries, telecom, entertainment, banking, finance, construction, manufacturing, technology as well. And the interesting thing about, I thought it would actually be tough to find lawyers of the quality that I want, because in Palladium, I won't bring somebody in unless they have at least 10 years of practice of law, seven of which has to be in an in-house environment, and they have to have had divisional or general counsel experience. I thought it was going to be tough to find those folks. And I've been really, really pleased that it hasn't been as tough as I thought it was going to be, because the people who are in-house counsel, they are 90% of the time in-house counsel because they love being in the business. They love being business people as well as lawyers. And so they want to stay that way. And whether they're semi-retired, like my telecom attorney, he left Bell South and AT&T after 30 years, but yet he's still in his 50s. So he doesn't want to sit on his rocking chair at the house. You know, he still wants to stay active, but he doesn't necessarily want to work 50 hours a week either.
Right.
Other people just enjoy, you know, as Bernie was saying, Bernie and I both have worked for, you know, small companies and growing companies as well as we have, you know, Fortune 50 companies. And a lot of us love helping the smaller companies and being involved in that early strategy of moving forward, and here's how we're going to create this, and here's how we're going to put this together. And a lot of people enjoy working with multiple companies in that regard as well. So they can work for more than one company, as long as they're not competitors, of course. And so that is really of great interest to the lawyers who've been in-house counsel.
That's a great point. I would think also, a lot of women wait to have children until they're older, but they've practiced law and maybe been an in-house attorney, and then to go back part-time mm-hmm. and still be able to dabble in that space. That's a great business model. So how long has your business been around?
I started this in 2007 mm-hmm. After I left a large international medical device company, and I wanted to start this company because I thought, you know, I've got to see what these younger companies are doing because they don't have anything available to them.
Right.
And so I saw that there's really nothing out here in the legal space. There's another company in San Diego or Orange County that I've been talking to. We talk and we cross refer, but there's just the two of us in the whole country doing this.
That's amazing. What a niche.
Mm-hmm. I know. There has to be more around the corner, though.
Yeah, good news, bad news, right? Good news is that there's nobody else doing it. Bad news is there's not anybody else out there helping me educate. We are pioneers in this space, and we hope that there'll be a lot more out there to follow, and that the business will start understanding and knowing how to use the in-house counsel versus the law firm lawyer, which is, if I already have a law firm lawyer, why do I need another lawyer? You know, I know when I have a legal issue, and so my hope is that gone are the days of I'll pick up the phone and I'll call you when I need you kind of thought process about the lawyers.
That's a great point, too. You know, you really don't know what you need unless there's somebody there
right.
mm-hmm. all the time or part-time, but actually having someone in-house. It's kind of unique, too, to see that there are a lot of people out there that have the desire to learn the business and be in a business environment but still be an attorney, because most of the attorneys I know, they're either a patent attorney mm-hmm. or, like you said, they have a vertical market and they don't really venture out of that.
Yeah.
And they don't have – this is not very nice, but they don't have the kind of personality and business interaction and people skills that you're talking about. And it would make a lot of sense to have someone that has the desire to learn the business mm-hmm. and – to move forward with the legal.
And just like the CFO and CPAs, there are different roles and there are different ways that a lawyer can perform in this industry. And we need the law firm lawyers as much as we need the in-house counsel. So we each perform different things, but we don't want to cross over. The in-house counsel are miserable in law firms, and the law firm lawyers who like that, you know, specialty and like to do that research, they can't function inside the corporation. So you can't go up to the CEO and say, no, you can't do that. Period. End of statement.
Yeah. And then walk away.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, that doesn't work inside a corporation or in a management team meeting.
Bernie, any final thoughts from you?
Well, I think there's one issue that's there. It's not intuitively obvious, perhaps to listeners. In many of these small emerging growth companies, time is the most valuable commodity. There's never enough of it. Yeah, maybe it's a close second to money. There's never enough mm-hmm. of that either. And just, you know, the value of an hour, it may seem silly, but if I don't have in-house counsel and I'm looking at a legal situation where I need some outside advice, it may take me an hour or two just to bring he or she in as an outside counsel, bring them up to speed, give them the background. And it's only an hour or two, but, you know, the opportunity cost of where I could have spent that hour or two solving another problem, pitching another potential investor, calling on another potential client.
Right.
Particularly if it's a recurring situation, it does add up. And I guess the other side of that is there are two dynamics I have seen happen in almost predictably in emerging growth companies. When outside investment dollars come in, everything changes. And on the top of the list of that everything is where senior management now must spend a certain percentage of their time every week, attracting capital. And once capital comes in, investor relations and all the aspects of that. And when a disgruntled investor appears, that can suck up any remaining time you have in that month. It really can. And then, of course, the other obvious one is that if I do come into litigation or the threat of litigation, big chunks of time. If I'm week to week, the thought of a sizable settlement, you know, could put me out of business. It literally could put me out of business. I remember my fourth year at Home Depot, they announced a $104 million settlement of some litigation. It wouldn't make the second decimal place of a, you know, $35 billion Home Depot. I've been in companies where a $10,000 settlement means we don't make payroll. Mm-hmm. Literally.
Right.
So the you know, I guess I'm trying to paint the picture of the dynamics of the day-to-day, week-to-week of the small emerging growth company and additional, not perhaps not so obvious value of the CLO model.
You did a good job painting the picture. So our listeners that have been listening and think, gosh, I need to call Don, how can they reach you?
Well, our website is www.palladiumclos.com, and that's spelled PalladiumClos.com. And our office number is 404-347-0999.
Wow.
Cool.
Great information.
Yeah. What an innovator.
You know, it's very rare that I meet an attorney that kind of thinks outside the box and is creative, and I think I might have to hang with Don. I got to get some triathlon training.
Yeah, there we go.
I would like that. Well, Don, thank you so much for being with us today, and best of luck with your ventures and growing your business. Maybe Don needs to come on in a year, and we have to see where Palladium is.
Yeah, all over the world.
Yeah, mm. I love success stories. Don, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Until next week, I'm Amy Otto with the Atlanta Business Radio Show. Have a wonderful week.